Everybody, thanks for coming to this talk at 7:45 in the morning. Is that particularly early for you? Yeah, it seems early to me too. All right. So my name is Robert Green. I'm a technical evangelist with Microsoft in Redmond. So I'm very happy to get a chance to come over here and hang out with you. My email address is rogreen@microsoft.com. If you have any questions about this, don't hesitate to give me an email. And there's my Twitter account. I'm also the host of the Channel 9 show Visual Studio Toolbox. Anybody watch that? Excellent. A fan. Very good. So this talk is on building Windows 8 line of business apps. And if you think about it, we've spent a lot of time introducing Windows 8. We spent a lot of time talking about building apps. And when we talk about building apps, we focus very heavily on the consumer apps, which you can understand why. We introduced a new platform. We introduced the Surface, which is competing with the iPad and the Android devices. And there aren't a lot of people that go to the store and say, I want to buy a Surface because I want to run my line of business applications on it. No, of course not. They want Facebook what else? The Kindle Reader and a whole list of applications on it. So we spent a lot of time on that. But, of course, it turns out that you can build an app and the app can do pretty much anything. So what I wanted to do in this talk is review some of the technologies that we'll use in building Windows 8 line of business applications. And one of the main points about this is that the technology, a lot of the things you do are going to be exactly the same as the things you're doing today building line of business apps. So who here has built a line of business app in WPF, Windows Presentation Foundation? Okay, you use XAML, you use C# or VB, you talk to WCF services, you talk to SQL Server. A lot of the things that you've done are going to apply. And then if you're building web apps as well, there's also some things that apply as well. I'm a C# XAML guy, so that's what all the code's going to be in today. But what I hope you come away with saying is if you go through the entire talk and you say, well, you didn't show me anything new. I already know how to do all of that. That's great because that's the whole point. You already know how to do most of what you need to do to build Windows 8 apps, and you already know most of what you need to know to build Windows 8 line of business apps. There will, of course, be some things that you haven't seen before, but more of it's going to be familiar than brand new. So we'll talk about accessing data. We'll talk about authenticating users. Obviously, if you're going to provide corporate data to somebody on a mobile device, maybe stick the data in the cloud, you want a way to ensure that only the right people get to that data. We'll talk very briefly about securing the data, talk a little bit about testing and deploying, and then review some of the things that we introduced a couple weeks ago at Build that come with Windows 8.1 Update 1. Who here has that already? Okay, and who has Visual Studio 2013 Update 2RC? Okay. Nothing I do is going to rely on that version of Visual Studio, but that's the one I'm using. A couple of things that I'm going to show do rely on Windows 8.1 Update 1. And I'm glad that we're back to long product names again. As the first product manager for the Microsoft Visual Studio Tools for the Microsoft Office system, I like long names. Okay, so you're going to build an application, a line of business application. The first thing you want to talk to is data. That's the very first thing I ever do when I get a new technology, whether it was Windows 8 or Windows Phone or WCF or whatever it was. I play around with data because I'm a data guy from way back. So in a mobile scenario, you've got a couple options on where the data lives, right? You build a desktop application, the data is going to live in a SQL Server or an Oracle database sitting somewhere in the network. You connect to it, and that's good. In a mobile scenario, the data can live in a number of places. You can, of course, connect to corporate data on premises, or you can talk to the data in the cloud. And in that case, if you've got, say, a WCF service, which we're going to use, living on the corporate network, you go into Visual Studio, you right-click, you add service reference, you connect to it, Visual Studio builds the proxy class for you, and then you just talk to it the same way you always have. And we're also going to see that you can do the same thing, take that WCF service, host it on an Azure website, and then connect to it in the same way. So that doesn't really change. So if you're going to be talking to data in a service way, if you're going to be reusing your existing WCF services, it's very straightforward. Now, in all likelihood, you're going to be looking at samples out on Microsoft, and you'll discover that we talk a lot about Web API these days. We don't talk as much about WCF. WCF, of course, is still there, but we're spending admittedly more time working on Web API than WCF. So if you're starting from scratch to build a service, you probably ought to consider writing it in Web API, because you're going to get better help from the tools. You're going to get better help from a lot of the samples out there. We'll see this particularly when we look at the authentication stuff. But if you've got an existing WCF service, there's no need necessarily to rewrite it as Web API or stick a Web API front end in front of it just to make it a little bit easier to use from the tools. Now, in a mobile scenario, people sometimes will be connected, sometimes they won't be connected. So you'll want to think about where you store data locally. Now, as you know, Windows 8 and 8.1 didn't support directly talking to SQL Express. So there's a few other options you can use. One is to store data in XML files. You can store data in JSON files. If you're building a web application, you can use something called IndexedDB. And then, of course, you can use SQLite, which, in terms of a SQL database, is kind of the one we prefer. And that would also give you the ability to support offline scenarios as well. So let's take a quick look at some of these. The application data APIs give you the ability to talk to files locally. They're designed for things like settings and unstructured data files. So if you just want to bring down a list of currencies, or you want to bring down a list of your customers, some data that doesn't change very often, or you want to store application settings, where the user was the last time they entered the system, what their preferences are, that's what the application data APIs were designed for. They give you both local and roaming data storage. There's no limit to the file size, but there is a limit to the amount of data that you can roam. If you're building a web application, building JavaScript, you can use IndexedDB. That supports both structured and indexed data storage. It's designed to hold simple values and hierarchical objects. I've tried using it as a database before. I didn't really get that far with it. So again, I think it's better not used to replace the relational database, but more used to store. Lookup tables would be fine if you've got a list of colors or a list of countries or whatever. We're going to see in our demo that we're going to use the application data APIs in place of a database, but it's really not designed for that. And then there's SQLite. Who here has played with SQLite before? Okay, a couple people. It's an in-process library. It's a transactional SQL database engine. It's nice and lightweight. It's very fast. The database is contained in a single file that lives on your hard drive. It's got a very small memory footprint. It's free. It's open source. It's not created by Microsoft. It's not supported by Microsoft, but it's very heavily used. And we use it a lot in our demos as well. And there is an extension for Visual Studio called the SQLite for Windows Runtime Extension. So if you're building applications in C#, VB, and C++, then you can use SQLite. There's no reason why you can't use SQLite if you're a JavaScript developer, but nobody at this point that I'm aware of has written the extension for Visual Studio to support JavaScript. I'm not sure why nobody's done that yet, but hopefully somebody will soon. Okay, so let's go take a look at that. Okay, so in our first example, we're going to look at using application data. So let me just run the app very quickly. It's a very simple application to manage customers and projects. So when I start the application, I see my customers. And then if I click, I can see projects. If I right-click, I get an app bar for editing. There's the edit. And over on the right is the ability to add. And then if I click on one of these, I go in and I can edit this or delete it. So it's a very simple project. I didn't spend an awful lot of time on the UI. I just wanted to have an application that works. Okay, so when I run this, and I'm using MVVM here, again, because this is all done in XAML. So if we look at the project structure, I've got view models, I've got views, and then I've got a library, customer's app data library, which does all the work, and then this data manager class is the one that actually does the work to go get the data. Okay? And I'll make this code. This code will all be available so you can look at it at your leisure. But when we run this, let's try this again. When we run this, the first thing that happens is we get customers, we build a new list of customer, then we go and get the customers, which are contained in this customers.xml file, which is sitting in applicationdata.current.local folder. Now, the way it works in Windows Store applications is that every application gets its own folder. And oh, it's kind of hard to see, but it is C users, RO green, which is me, app data, dot local, backslash local, packages, and then a GUID, which is the unique identifier for that application. Okay, so if we go into folder here, C colon users, RO green, app data, local, Microsoft. No, that wasn't it. I skipped one. It wasn't Microsoft. It was local packages, sorry. Local packages. And then this one, the package number for this is the one that begins with 96CE. Which is this one here, and then we go into local state, and here's my customers and projects XML files sitting in that folder. Okay, so that's my data for this application. Okay, so I get a reference to that file, then I'm going to open it as a stream, I'm going to serialize it to a list of customers, and then I'm going to read that. And the net result will be that I get a list of customers. There's four of them, and there they are. Okay. This thing doesn't show up that well when I use Zoom, it does it. That's unfortunate. Okay. Same thing if I want to get projects, and then if I wanted to get a specific customer, then what I do is I open that file, read it into a list of customers, and then I do a link query to get a particular customer. And what I'm doing if I save is I originally said, well, if I'm going to save, I should go find that customer and overwrite it, but I got lazy. I didn't feel like doing that much work, so I just nuked the file and recreated it from all the customers. So obviously that's extremely inefficient code, but I'm dealing with four customers and half a dozen projects, and for very small amounts of data, which is really all that Application Data API is good for, that should be fine. So for an example, if you're giving this application to a technician who's visiting four customers that day, you could absolutely use this, download the data as XML or JSON files, and then give them the ability to retrieve that data offline, make changes to it, and then send it back up. I wouldn't use this for anything more than small amounts of data, but for very small amounts of data, this certainly works. Okay, then let's look at SQLite. SQLite is a database, and for that, I absolutely would recommend using it for fairly large amounts of data. Okay, so here, my data manager is the one that gets all of, that talks to SQLite and gets the data. So now when this application starts up, what I'm going to do is go find the customers.s3db. You can call the database anything you like. I call this one S3db because there's a free SQLite management tool out there that kind of looks like SQL Server Management Studio, and that defaults to S3DB, so that's a good enough extension. But you can use anything you want. And the data here is stored in the same place, windows.storage, application data, current local folder, path, which again is this package folder, and there, right there, is my customer's database. Okay? So then what I'm going to do is create a connection to it using SQLite.SQLite connection, connect to the database, and then create the tables if they don't exist. So in my model, I have customer and project, and these are just POCO classes, plain old CLR object classes, attributed with primary key and auto increment, which would be very familiar to you from SQL Server. So SQLite supports the primary key and auto increment connotations on the data. So I've got customers and projects. And if those don't exist, I'm going to create them. And what this will then do is I'm going to say customers equals db.tableCustomer. This gets a reference to that customer database. It doesn't retrieve all the data. That's not equivalent to a select star from customer. It just gets a pointer to that. And if there are no customers in there, then I'm going to reset the data for demo purposes. And this reset data will nuke all the contents of customers and projects and then add a customer. So db.insert, an instance of the customer class, will add a new customer, and then I add project. So single line of code to insert into a SQLite database. Okay, if I want to get all of the customers, then I am doing this asynchronously, db.tableCustomer. I can order by customer name. To list async will basically get all the customers and put them in a list of customers. Okay, so let's go down to here. We connect to the database, grab all the customers, and customers, there's four of them, and there they are. Okay, for projects, then I'm going to get the projects for a particular customer, and again, I'm using link queries here. If I want to get a particular customer, then just a simple where clause. Get the first instance of that. If I want to do a save, then what I can do is right here, I can do db.updateAsync and pass in the instance of the customer that I want to update. So there, I'm updating an individual one. And if I want to delete, then the code looks like this. db.deleteAsync. I delete all the projects and then I delete the customer. Okay? And what it looks like is like this. The application, of course, works exactly the same. Am I still on a breakpoint? Let's go. Okay. I should have taken that breakpoint out. There we go. So to get SQLite, first thing that we do, let's just very quickly show, let's create a brand new project. We'll create a blank Windows Store app. Okay. Then in Tools, Extensions, and Updates, I've got SQLite for Windows Runtime here, which you can find in the Visual Studio Gallery. So what you would do if you don't have it yet is go online, search for SQLite. Should show up. It's not showing up. The other thing you can do is go to SQLite.org and get the VSIX file from it. I'm not sure why it doesn't show up in the gallery from Visual Studio. All right, but then what we do is we set a reference to it. So right-click here, add reference. And if we go to Assemblies, Windows 8.1, Extensions, then there's SQLite for Windows runtime there. Select that. We also have to grab the C++ 2013 runtime package because SQLite is written in C++. So we add that. And at that point, you may notice the yellow triangles with exclamation marks. If we try and build this, it won't build because the architecture is set to any CPU, and because we're using C++, we have to specify the architecture. So we go into Build Configuration Manager, and then we choose either x86 or 64 or ARM. Inside Visual Studio, you should choose x86 because the XAML designer doesn't support 64-bit because, of course, Visual Studio is a 32-bit application. So just choose x86 for development purposes. And now this would build. Then what you do is you go into the NuGet packages and you search online for SQLite-net, which is what gives you the ability to talk to the SQLite database using Link. So absolutely get that, and we thank Kruger Systems. What's his first name? Anybody remember? Anybody know Kruger's first name? Sorry, I apologize for forgetting it, but thanks to him for writing this. And that is what gives us the ability to talk to the SQLite database using these link queries. So that's absolutely a must to have a SQLite. Okay? All right, so that's a quick overview of using SQLite. So the next thing that we want to do is, oh, I accidentally shut down Visual Studio. Next thing we want to do is look at using services. So I have a WCF service here. This is just a garden variety WCF service. Right, which uses Entity Framework. So I've got an Entity Framework data model here, and obviously using Link to talk to the data. This is about as straightforward and as familiar WCF service as it gets. And that's living internally, and I want to be able to talk to that from my front end. So what I do in my WCF library, which is where I have my service references, is I have two service references in here. One to customer's WCF service, which is this WCF service living locally. And then I stuck it in Azure on an Azure website, and I have a different service for that. And then depending on which of these lines of code I uncomment, I can talk to the local service or to the one sitting in Azure. So if I'm talking to the local service, just create a new instance of customer service client, call get customers async, that returns a list of customers, and I just go. Very, very straightforward, kind of boring, which is good because it means that you already know how to do this. All right, run the application, and now I'm talking to WCF locally to get my customers and projects. And this, of course, is a very familiar pattern for working with data internally. Now it turns out I'm going to want to go visit customers and I want to be able to access this data when I'm not on the corporate network. What do I do? Well, what I did here was I took this WCF service and I published it to an Azure website. So to do that, all I need to do is go to my Azure Management Portal. Come on, go to the Azure Management Portal. There we go. Which hopefully shows up soon. Okay, sign in. I'm I'm only on the wireless here. I'm not on wired, so it's... We have to be patient. Which, if anybody knows me, knows is very hard for me. Excellent. Okay. Well, so pretend we went to the Azure portal and we created a website. It's very easy to create an Azure website. It's basically a little wizard. You go to the websites tab, you click new, you specify the name of the website, the region you want it in, you click OK, and you're ready to go. Let's see if we can actually still talk to the website. That would be good. So it is customers.azurewebsites.net. Is that the right one? Yep. Yes, so the website exists and the WCF service is sitting on it, so that's good. Okay, so to publish it, you just right-click on the solution, on the project, you say publish website, and then Visual Studio gives you a nice wizard for connecting to your Azure websites. It signs in for you, and then it gives you a list of your websites in this drop-down. So I chose customers, right like that. Said OK. And then I just clicked next a few times, and I clicked publish, and that published that WCF service to the Azure website. Okay. Then from Visual Studio, I created a service reference to that. And called the client's, the customer service client, passing in the address of it as an endpoint configuration, and then the rest of the code is exactly the same. And now, assuming that I have internet connectivity, cross your fingers, drum roll. Okay, unauthorized. Well, that's actually good, but that was a later demo. Okay, so I'm not authorized to talk to that. I got my demos mixed up, but this is pointing to... This was supposed to point to a different one. Which one is this talking to? Customer service. Okay, well, I secured the wrong one. All right, fine. But that's good. So that was actually, that wasn't supposed to happen till later, but we're talking to the service. So anyway, so whether you're talking locally to application data for small amounts of data or using SQLite as a database, that gives you great local capabilities for offline scenarios, for online scenarios. If you're using your existing WCF services, very, very easy to do. Just point to it, or you can put it in Azure and then point to it. Very, very familiar. Here's a couple resources for you for learning a little bit more about that. Okay, so now we have data in the application. Let's move on to design considerations. So who here, I know I asked you this before, but who's written line of business applications before in anything from Fox Pro to Access to Windows Forms to WPF? Okay, so you remember the good old days. Yeah, when we wrote applications that looked like this. Some of us are not old enough to have written ever written applications like this. Good for you. You'll grow up to be as old as the rest of us one of these days. But these are the applications we used to write. The idea was to get as much data onto the form as possible because your users, and they still say this, the users want to look at the screen and see everything. They don't want to have to navigate around. They just want all of the information in one place, and they're happy to scroll up and down to find it. Even if we do something that's a little bit more modern looking like this, we still jam all this information on the screen. We've got hyperlink buttons here, over here, over here. We've got tabs to go back and forth. Again, the idea is jam as much information as possible onto the screen. And that works fine for desktop applications. It works sort of fine for websites, but it is not the whole point of building applications that run on tablets. It's not the design language on the iPad. It's not the design language on the Android. It's certainly not the design language on Windows 8. What we want to do instead is evolve our applications from being all about the data to being all about data plus a bunch of toolbars and what we call Chrome to being more immersive. So we want more of an immersive experience. And I'm using the SAP Customer Financial Factsheet application here, which you can actually get in the Windows Store and use demo data with. So let's fire that up. I think this is a very good example of... Where is it? In fact sheet. There it is. I knew I had it. So this is currently using demo data. In real life, of course, this would be hooked up to your SAP system. But this is the more immersive experience that people are used to on their tablets. They're not necessarily used to it on their desktop. And we recognize that particularly in Windows 8, some people have found the movement from the desktop to the modern UI rather jarring. But over time, as people get more and more used to their mobile devices and the idea that line of business apps, a Windows 8 line of business app should look and feel like a Windows 8 app so that it's easier to use, you'll want to start giving people more of a UI like this. So this works pretty well when you don't have a huge amount of customers. If you had 200 or 300 customers, I don't know how much scrolling back and forth you want people to do. You'd in that case, want to give people a little bit more ability to filter and search on the front page. But here's all the data. If I tap or click on one of these, then it loads up that information. This information in the SAP case is coming from five or six different back ends and being presented in one place. There's everything you need to know about your customers. Here are the key facts on them. There's charts, there's notes, and if you scroll from side to side, then you can see additional information. If you want to look at an invoice, you just tap on it, you go into that invoice, and you can see various information, and then, of course, you can always go back very easily. Now, if you have a bunch of information that's on the screen, yes, you can scroll side to side. What you can also do is give people the ability to do semantic zoom. Take two fingers and pinch in, and then we switch to this kind of scrolling out view where we look at the categories. And you can provide information on there. We know there's four invoices, for example. Tap on that, and then you go back in. With the mouse, if you look down in the lower right corner, there's this dash. If you click on that, then you go into semantic zoom. Okay? And then this, because it's Windows 8 app, it gives us the ability to do something like this. If we click on the address, then we can launch Bing Maps. The application, the SAP application, knows that we've launched something else, so it goes into this smaller view and is now in more of a vertical mode, but it still completely works. I can tap on that and I can view invoices while at the same time looking at the map side by side. Okay, so this... You are looking at the map experience for the United States, but you appear to be in a different region. That's it. Yes, I am. Do you want to change the region? Sure. No, I guess I won't. All right, so then we can make this any size we want. This, of course, is new in 8.1, the ability to have more than just snap and fill mode. Okay, so that's a good example of a line of business app moved into Windows Store. And I would suggest that you do that for the apps that you build yourself. So the idea is to keep the design clean. It's content over Chrome, right? Think about it. You launch Outlook. How much of the screen real estate is devoted to reading email and how much of it is devoted to telling you, oh, there's email in these other folders. Oh, here's the ribbon. Here's a bunch of things you could do to that email if you weren't too busy reading it. Right? So a whole bunch on the side, whole bunch on the top. There's status bars on the bottom. Same thing with Word. Same thing with Excel. One of the design goals of Windows 8 is what we call content over Chrome. I launched an app because I wanted to view some information. I launched the weather app to see the weather. I didn't necessarily launch the weather app to know that I could see tomorrow's forecast before it shows me what the weather is currently now. So the idea is that when people come into an application, they want to be able to get in, get the job done, and do it very quickly and cleanly. And then in terms of navigation, you give them scrolling, you give them navigation bars. A good example of the navigation bar would be something like the sports or news app. I come in. So here's a perfect example of content over Chrome. I tap the sports app because I wanted to read about sports. So here's an article on sports. If I scroll to the right, there's a whole bunch of additional information. And then if I swipe up, there's the navigation bar to move to different parts of the application. And then the bottom is the app bar, which gives me the ability to work on this particular article to either refresh or help. So you would put that into your line of business applications. We don't need tabs for customers, projects, pending projects, invoices. We put that into the navigation bar. Very easy to get to, but not taking up screen real estate right away. And then things that you can do to an existing, in our case, we were looking at customers and projects. So let's actually go back and work with the service that isn't authenticated at the moment. Now, for this, I didn't add navigation bars because you're just looking at customers and projects. But in the app bar in the bottom is the ability to add a new customer or edit an existing customer. And then when I select a customer, in the app bar is the ability to, again, when I select a customer and look at the projects, add and edit. And if I'm looking at a particular customer, save and delete are in the bottom. And notice that in this case, the app bar automatically shows up. The reason being is that when I'm looking at customers, I'm not going to make a presumption that the user wants to add one or edit one. Maybe they just want to find a customer, click on it, and view the projects. But the second I select it, notice the app bar comes up because the reason I selected it is because I want to edit it. And then if I go in and edit one of these, when I edited it, there's only three things I'm going to do. Save some information, delete this customer, or change my mind. And all three of those choices are now available on the screen. I don't have to swipe up to save. Okay, this app bar now automatically shows up, and the back button's already there. So that's a little bit about using Windows Store applications. The other thing, Windows Store line of business applications, the other thing you should look at are the tiles. I think that this is one of the key things about Windows 8, one of the nice things about the start screen. If you think about the desktop is a pretty picture and a bunch of icons that tell you things you can do. Double-click on this, an application will launch. Double-click on this, an application will launch and open this document. But it doesn't give you any information. The start screen's giving me information. The mail app in the upper left is telling me I have 53 unread emails, and it's scrolling through my most recent emails, both on my work account as well as my personal account. The calendar application is showing me my upcoming meeting. The finance application over here is showing me what the stock market's doing. Okay, these tiles are live. The apps aren't running. The application registers with Windows. Windows on a periodic basis goes out and talks to a server and sends information back. Now you can do that with consumer apps. You can also do that with line of business apps. And one of my favorite examples of that is Spotfire, which is a BI application. So when I come in, it shows me my favorites. It shows me comments. So let's go look at some favorites. So for example, the New York region. Click on that. And what I want to do is I want to put this tile on the desktop. So if I right click, then down in the lower left, you see a button called Pin. I'm going to pin this to the start screen, call it New York. And I'll come back and pin Charlotte, North Carolina to the start screen. And let's get one more. Let's get one red, one green, one yellow. Let's pin the West. Okay. So now, let's shut down this app. Come over here. And if we look all the way over on the right, notice that there are now three new secondary tiles for each of these, and they're live. And so what that means is I can take this information, move it all the way over here, and now when I come in the morning, turn on my computer, the computer is now giving me information. Before I've even finished my first cup of coffee, I can see that New York is red. The actual was 240, the target was 252. There's something wrong. I tap on that. The application knows. You can query when an application starts. Did it start because the user pressed on the primary tile, or did it start because the user pressed on the secondary tile? When you create a secondary tile, you give it a unique ID, like the word New York or the ID of New York. And then when the app starts, you query why did the app start. If it started on New York, you go directly there. So if you think about this, what's now happening is we've turned the start screen into a dashboard. And you can do this with your line of business apps as well. It's a handful of lines of code to create a secondary tile. It's a handful of lines of code to register the tile and tell it what information to go get. So you create these live secondary tiles, and when the users come in, whether it's a list of customers they need to talk to, or regions where the sales aren't working, or you know what building has printers that are down, or whatever it is, by taking advantage of the live tiles and the live secondary tiles, you turn your user's start screen into their dashboard. So it's not this liveness of the start screen is not just for consumer apps, it's also for line of business apps as well. Okay. Where are we? Where are we in the presentation? There we are. Okay. And there's some good links for more information on design, navigation, tiles, etc. Okay, now let's talk a little bit about authentication since I already showed it to you a little bit. We've put corporate data in Azure. We've got sensitive data living on the WCF service. We want to make sure that only the correct people can talk to it. So what are our options? Well, the first thing to remember is Windows 8 is Windows. And so if you are on a domain-joined machine, you automatically have Windows authentication. So just as you did with Windows 7 and Vista and XP, you also do with Windows 8. If you are domain-joined, Windows knows who you are and is automatically going to pass your domain credentials to any service that you call. So you don't have to do anything on a machine that's domain joined. So this machine here is a 64-bit machine running Windows Enterprise. It's domain joined. I'm done, right? I'm done to the same extent I've always been done. If you are on a non-domain joined machine, for instance, you're on a Windows RT machine or you happen to be on a Windows 8 machine that's not domain joined, there is an option to do a workplace join, which was introduced in Windows 8.1. And what that basically gives you the ability to do is provide your domain credentials and talk to internal resources. So if you've got information sitting in a SharePoint site or something, user brings their own device, brings their Surface, wants to be able to talk to that information, you can set them up with Workplace Join and give them access to that information. And then what you can do is when you kick them out of the Workplace Join or when they unjoin the workplace, then they no longer have access to that information. You can set up smart cards and virtual smart cards in your machines. I have virtual smart cards set up on all of my machines. So if I want to go into the CorpNet, for example, I go to Settings. I go to Direct Access. It asks me for my credentials. I don't have to put in my employee badge with the little what's the word I'm looking for? Chip. Thank you. It's early. I don't have to put my badge in with the chip anymore. And on this machine, I need an external reader. I just set up a virtual smart card. I log in, and I can connect to the CorpNet. Okay, so you can do that for authentication. Windows 8.1 introduced fingerprint authentication in system windows.security.credentials.ui. There is a user consent verifier class, which gives you the ability, assuming that your computer has a fingerprint reader or that you have an external fingerprint reader, then you can do authentication via fingerprints. You can also use Active Directory authentication, obviously using that internally. But we're going to see a couple examples of how to use that with Windows Azure and use Windows Azure, or excuse me, Microsoft Azure Active Directory. We recently renamed it to Microsoft Azure. It's going to take us probably a year to stop calling it Windows Azure. You, of course, could also use custom credentials. So you could, if you wanted to, create a database of usernames and passwords and maybe use the ASP.NET membership provider. But the problem there is that you're in charge of remembering, of keeping track of usernames and passwords. You're in charge of providing UI if somebody forgets their password. So maybe what you do instead is use their Microsoft account, or you could use Facebook or Google or Yahoo, etc. So the idea of single sign-on is becoming very popular. I'm not 100% sure how we all feel about validating you for your corporate data using your Facebook ID. I think that works maybe a little bit better in a consumer scenario. But if you had vendors coming in, you could certainly do that. You just need a way to verify them. If it's not, you know, depending on the data they're getting to, depending on who they are, you could rely on the Microsoft account or something else. But because we're using corporate data here, let's look at using something a little bit more rigorous for our purposes. Okay, so first thing is for the internal data. I want to open up this website. And I want this to be secured customers local WCF service. And what I did here is I said this service should use Windows authentication. So all you need to do is come into the config file, add a binding, and set security mode to transport credential only and credential type to Windows, and then make sure that the endpoint uses that binding's behavior. And so this basically here is all you need to do to set up this WCF service to require Windows authentication. Okay? That, of course, there is nothing new. That's been in WCF for quite some time. Okay, and then what we do is come over and open up this version of the application. So this version of the application now needs to authenticate you. Now, for demo purposes, if I just ran the application, then it would work because I'm domain joined, right? And I've already logged on. So this machine would pass to that WCF service my domain credentials, and it would completely work. What I want to do for demo purposes is show you what would happen if I wasn't domain joined. So what I want to do is prompt the user for their password. And what I'm using is the Credential Picker class, which ships as part of Windows 8. And what that does is it pops up a UI. And the beautiful thing about this UI is it looks like it comes from Windows. Yes, it's not that hard to create a dialog box that pops up and says, show me, you know, enter your username and password. But to make it look like it's something that's more part of the system, I think is a little more trustworthy, right? So now I have my options. I can log in with my domain credentials. I can also use my virtual smart card. So I'm going to log in with my domain credentials. In real life, I would check remember my credentials, but I never checked that in the demo because then this dialogue never comes up again and it's not a great demo. So now, if I log in correctly, I can get to this information. And if I don't log in correctly, if I misspell this, it lets me in anyway because I'm domain joined. What a great demo. Okay, so what are we doing? So I'm calling from my main view model a method called authenticate with Windows credentials, which is going to do this. It's going to call the credential picker class, and the method is pick.async. I pass in my company, I pass in the text and the title, and then I grab the username, the password, and the domain name. So let's put a breakpoint right here. Let's run this. So it's this call to credentials.pickasync that shows this dialog. Okay. And of course, it matches my color scheme because I have a red background. So I get all of this for free. And then the username is stored, RO green. The domain name is stored in cred picker results. And then the password, which of course is hashed. So no worries about that. And you can store this locally. There's a credential vault. And then what I'm going to do is return whether I'm an app domain user or whether the username is not empty. So that's going to tell me that I'm authenticated or not. And then what I'm going to do when I get customers, step into this, okay, and then step into this, go into the domain manager to get customers. Okay, so what I need to do is I need to pass those credentials with every call to the service. So I create a new instance of customer's service client, and then what I do is I set the client credential of this, customer's service client.clientcredentials.windows.clientcredential, to a new instance of a network credential, and I pass in Windows username, the password, and the domain name, which I've stored as application-level variables. And then every time I call the service, I'm going to pass those credentials with it. Okay? And therefore, every call I make to the service is authenticated, and the application works. I have to look at that demo, and there's something in my code that's not checking whether you logged in correctly, because it shouldn't have let me in. Okay. So then the other example, and this is the one we saw earlier, I want to do that with the Azure WCF service. Okay. So what I did here in the web.config is I specified bearer token required. Okay. And then I added a behavior extension, gave it bearer token extension element. And what that does is require me to pass a token. So the way Azure Active Directory authentication works is you talk to a server, pass it credentials, and it sends you back a token. So these changes to the web.config now force this service to expect authorization. I then published this to Azure, and it's going to require me to pass a token. And then this bearer token class says, where's the service and where is it that you're going to be authenticating? So I went into Windows Azure. I created an Active Directory tenant called customers by RO green because other people had used customers before. So this is my customers tenant. And then what this, along with the rest of the code here, says is when you try to use the application, when you talk to this service, we're going to redirect you to this website which prompts you for your credentials. And then if you're authenticated, we're then going to receive the token and then, of course, pass that every time you make a request. Okay, and so what we need in the front end, which is not new, open. This is demo 2 Azure WCF. What we essentially need is to create an authorized customer's service client. So we can't just use, remember we did a service reference. When we create a new instance of that customer service client, that proxy class, we need to make it an authorized version. So I've added a service authorizer, which is going to get the authorized header, and we've got, where is it? Yeah, so the authorized service class, it's a new instance of, we pass in the service authorizer and it should be in, yes. So customer, in the customer data service, we get this service authorizer. And I just want to show you that code. Where did I put that? There it is. Windows 8 Service Authorizer. So it's code that looks like this that is going to know where to go talk to. And the end result of this is when I run this application, talking to that WCF service in Azure that's expecting authorization, I'm going to get a login like this. It says log into your Azure Active Directory tenant. Customers by rogreen.onmicrosoft.com. And then I log in. And assuming the internet connection is working. There we go. Now I'm authorized. Okay. Now, admittedly, the code for this is pretty gnarly when you're using WCF services with Azure Active Directory. There's a lot of samples. Vittorio Bertocci, my good friend Vittorio, and has written a bunch of samples, and they all use Web API. So it's quite a bit easier to do this if you're using Web API than using WCF. It's kind of gnarly to do it with WCF. I'm going to write this up on my blog, and I will tweet about it. So check on Twitter or if a week goes by or so and you want more information on how to do this, just shoot me an email. And I'm going to write up how to do this with WCF, make it a little bit more understandable, because admittedly it's not that easy. It's a lot easier to do if you're using mobile services. And I actually have a version of this project that uses mobile services. That was the third service I was supposed to show. Who here's used Azure Mobile Services or has seen how to do it? Okay. So the basic thing about Azure Mobile Service is it is a database and a cloud service hosted on a website created for you automatically. So you go to the Azure portal, you create an Azure Mobile Service, and you get the database, you get the service that will talk to it in a RESTful manner, and it's hosted on an Azure website. And then to talk to it, you need to know the location. So this one is on vstoolboxdemo.azuremobile.net. You get a secret password, which I will change pretty soon because now I've shown everybody what my password is for this site. But it's very easy, this secret here, it's very easy to regenerate it. And then to talk to a table, you just get table customer or get table project. It uses the equivalent of the Entity Framework code first model, so it will create these tables for you based from your model classes. Okay, and then you can talk to this data in a link-like manner. So here, customerTable.orderBy to enumerable iSync will return me a list of customers. So now this version of the application is going to talk to the same customers and projects data sitting in an Azure mobile service. Okay, works great. And then we can also authenticate those. So let's open up a version of this. And this is really easy to do. It's really easy to use Azure Active Directory authentication with a mobile service. So I create a method called authenticate async, and I call login async of the mobile service class, which is my mobile service client, and I pass what I want to use for authenticating. All right, so I type await mobile service dot login async, and then mobile service dot authentication provider. It ships with, did they show up? No. It ships with, out of the box, Facebook, Google, Microsoft account, Twitter, and Azure Active Directory. So you just specify. And then all that plumbing goo that we had to write in the WCF example is automatically handled for you. Okay, and now when I run this, talking to that Azure mobile service, which is now authenticated, I get this similar dialogue. And I log into my Azure tenant sitting in the cloud, and I can get to the data. All right, so that's authentication. And then the last important thing to remember about Azure Active Directory is you can sync it to your on-premises Active Directory. So you don't have to provide people a new set of credentials, and you don't have to be responsible for creating two versions of the Active Directory. Your on-premises AD syncs to the Azure AD, so your on-premises is the real one, and then it syncs to the Azure one. Okay, so that's authentication. What about security? You're sending data across the wire. Is it enough to just authenticate who can get to it, which would also give you the ability to do authorization? What if you also want to secure the data? In the Windows Security Cryptography Data Protection namespace, there are the protect and unprotect methods, which you may have, they've actually were in .NET Framework first, so those may be familiar to you. And then in windows.security.cryptography.core, there are a number of classes for doing encryption, signing, hashing, building symmetric and asymmetric keys. I'm not necessarily a huge expert on this, but I've taken a look at some of the classes and some of the samples that are in the Windows 8 samples, and there's some pretty high degree of encryption going on. So that's not that hard to do if you want to encrypt the data. Of course, if you are on a domain-joined machine with BitLocker, then anything sitting on the hard drive is protected. And then if you are on a workplace-joined machine, there is the ability when you create files to have them only accessible to the person while they're workplace joined, and when they are no longer part of the workplace, you can selectively wipe those files, or at the very least, people can't get to them. Okay, so on a Surface machine which doesn't have BitLocker, isn't domain joined, you should look into the workplace join if you're going to be creating files. Like that SQLite database, you would put it in a folder and such that the user could only open that database while, as long as they are workplace joined. When they are no longer workplace joined, even if you don't delete that file, they'll never be able to open it. Okay, so that's part of the workplace join feature. All right, a couple more references for that. For testing, obviously you test on the device, but what happens if you're testing on a Surface machine? You're not. If you have a Surface Pro, you might actually be developing on that machine. But if you have a different device, you're developing on your primary machine, and you want to test on a device, then you have the ability to do remote testing. You download on that device the remote tools for Visual Studio. There's x86, 64, and ARM versions for both Visual Studio 2012 and 2013, as well as a version for 2013 Update 1. There's also a version for 2013 Update 2. And then what you can do is connect your Visual Studio machine to that remote device. So if we go into Visual Studio and we want to we can do it in here in the project properties. And when we go to debug the target device, you can do the local machine, you can do simulator, or you can do a remote machine. So if the machine you want to test on is running those remote tools, you start those up, it's on the same subnet, then you can connect to it from your Visual Studio machine. And then what that happens is you need a developer license on the remote machine. Of course, log in with your Microsoft account, that's free. Then what Visual Studio will do is package up the app, transfer it to that machine, run it on that machine, and give you the ability to debug. Okay, that app is then on that machine, so you can continue to test it. And of course, you're licensed for debug and test. That is not a way to deploy apps in production, but it's certainly a way to get apps onto that machine for debugging and testing. So obviously, you should test often, but you really should test the application on the device. You can certainly test in the simulator, which will give you the ability to look at different screen sizes, but nothing beats testing on the actual device. And what you wind up doing is you wind up learning the hard way that an app works fine on your machine, and then you go to test it on a device, and because the screen's smaller, not all of the data shows up, and you forgot to add a scroll bar. Not that I've ever done that, of course. But the only way you would discover that is by actually running the app on the other machine. When you then discover that you were a knucklehead and not all the data fits and you forgot to add a scroll bar, if you test that, if you catch that in testing, that's better than if you are showing the app to your wife and then you discover that and you look like an idiot. Not that that's ever happened to me, of course. Okay. So in the last few minutes, let's talk a little bit about some things that are new in Update 1, Windows 8.1 Update 1. We've addressed some of the issues that customers have been reporting. One thing we've heard quite a bit of from people is their wish that Windows 8 supported more inter-process communication. Okay, so obviously what we did in Windows 8 was we introduced a confidence model for Windows Store apps because we didn't want to create this brand new tablet operating system and tablet and then give people just a faster, fluider way to download viruses and mess up their machines, right? One of the beautiful things about Windows and the openness is you can install anything at any time. And if you can install anything at any time, you can accidentally install malware. We decided with Windows 8 that we didn't want that. So we created a very secure confidence model, kind of a closed system, which works great for the consumer space, but when you move over into the enterprise space and you're trying to build enterprise applications, it was a little bit too closed down. So we want enterprises to have the flexibility of trading off confidence for capability. So there always has been in Windows 8.1, at least, the ability to do some inter-process communication, but it was only for dev and test, and you weren't allowed to do it, certainly weren't allowed to put it in a store app, but we didn't give you the ability to do it for side-loaded apps either. What we've done with Windows 8.1 Update 1 is we've removed the restriction for side-loaded applications. So you can make inter-process communication calls from Windows in a side-loaded application, and now that's supported. There's no restriction on that. If you try to put that into a Windows Store app, we'll reject the app in the store. But for side-loaded apps, you're given the ability to do that. Okay. And there's the network loopback adapter that's in there. We gave you, again, the ability to disable that for inter-process communication for dev and test before. Now that's allowed for side-loaded apps. So if you're going to side-load your enterprise apps, you do have those capabilities added. Then what we also did, and there's some cool demos of this in the keynotes at Build, and there was actually an entire talk, I believe, on these brokered WinRT components. So you've got existing applications running. Maybe it's a WinForms app that uses ADO. You know, we've heard from a lot of people, hey, there's no system.data in WinRT. I can't use ADO.net anymore. So what we decided in update one was to give you a way of calling existing code. So you now basically have the ability to essentially run any code from inside a Windows 8.1 app. You basically have the ability to punch a hole in the sandbox, if you will, and run code that's not part of the Windows runtime. That gets activated in a separate process. You got to globally register a proxy in a stub. You have to register it in the APEX manifest. There's some documentation on it. It's not exactly intuitive at the moment. This is also something that I want to possibly feature on my toolbox show, or certainly write up how to do this a little bit easier. But let me show you a demo of it so you'll see what we're talking about. So I've got an example. This was showed at Build. I've got both a server and a client. So what you basically do is you create a library with your code that's going to call code that's not in the Windows runtime. So for example, this. We're going to call a data set. If you remember, you know, lovingly, the data set from ADO. I'm not allowed to write this code in a Windows 8 app directly because that's not part of the WinRT. But I have this in this DLL, and we're going to read an XML file, customer data. Okay, and notice that this project, which is a Windows 8.1 project, has references to system.data, right? And system XML. So we're going to be able to call anything we want. We create this as a library, and then we reference this. It's a WinMD, which is the Windows RT library. Reference that from the client application. Okay, and that's the enterprise server. Enterprise server is that server that contains the ADO.NET code. And then there's some registering and copying over of files, but the end result is that I can call ADO.NET and get data and call that from a Windows store application. Okay, so I know that's a very quick overview of it. I do want to dive into a little bit more, so check out either Visual Studio Toolbox or blog, or just give me shoot me an email, and I'll let you know when I'm finished. I want to do a walkthrough that starts from scratch that shows how to do this. Okay, so you've got a couple capabilities. You can use the network loopback or the brokered WinRT. The loopback works on 8 and 8.1. The brokered runtime is part of 8.1. Okay, it's just WinRT programming with a network loopback. You can use it with WCF or REST services. The brokered RT loads the component on demand, and it supports suspended applications. So the callback will activate a suspended application with the network callback or the network loopback. It doesn't have that. Okay, so it's a nice feature added to update one, certainly worth exploring a little bit. Let's take a quick look at deployment, because we made some announcements there on Windows on update one. There's two ways that you can get an application on somebody's machine. One is you can put it in the store. Two is you can sideload it. So the benefit of putting an app in the store is we take care of the plumbing for you, the downloading, the updating. People know where the application is. So I would say if you're going to build a Windows Store line of business app and give it to your customers or your employees to use, you should really think about whether or not you can put it in the store. Because that way, they know where to get it. They can get it from wherever they are in any machine. And if you if you put an update in there, they will automatically get that update. One of the things that changed in Windows 8.1 is your apps automatically update now. In 8, you had to go pull down the updates. In 8.1, we pushed the updates down. Now, there are some applications that won't go in the store. Maybe it's internal processes you don't want your customers to know you have. Maybe your legal team won't allow it, or maybe you're worried about you don't think that Windows 8 apps are secure enough because they can be reverse engineered, so you don't want to put your app in the store, so you decide to install it through sideloading, which can be done with a PowerShell script, which can be done if you're running System Center Configuration Manager. You can set up essentially an internal company store. Okay. To sideload an app, you need to sign it with a trusted certificate, and that certificate needs to be trusted on all machines. Then there's a group policy setting on the device. You have to allow all trusted apps to install. And then you need to enable the device for sideloading. And this has been semi-controversial, I will say. If you're running Windows Enterprise and your domain joined, you were automatically sideloading enabled. Otherwise, you have to purchase a sideloading key, which are available through volume licensing. And what we've done in Update 1 is we've relaxed the restrictions on this. So here's the current rules. If you are domain joined running Enterprise or Pro, and that part's new, then you're automatically sideloading enabled. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to buy a sideloading key. You're ready to go. And you can obtain companion device keys for your Windows RT devices. So if you're in a volume license agreement and you have a license that covers your desktop machine, you would automatically get a key to unlock your RT at no extra charge. If you're an enterprise customer with an enterprise agreement or an enterprise subscription agreement, then we'll give you all the sideloading keys you need at no charge through your volume licensing center. And that's a change in update one. They used to cost $30 a pop and were available only in groups of 100. Then we cut the price to $10 a pop, available in groups of 100. Now we cut the price to no charge if you have the enterprise agreement or enterprise subscription agreement. Otherwise, you have to obtain keys. You have to have some form of a volume license agreement. It can be as little as an open license agreement. And then for $100, you get all the keys you need. So it's a lot easier to get them, and it's less expensive to get them than it has been in the past. And we're continuing to look at additional ways of making this easier. Okay, so that's basically the talk. So in 75 minutes, what we've seen is what are some of the things you're going to be doing if you're building a Windows 8 line of business app. Actually, talking to the data is surprisingly familiar. We didn't see an awful lot that was brand new there. We saw how to talk to data, whether it's local, SQLite, WCF, Azure Mobile Services. We put a WCF service in Azure. So whether the data is living on the device or internally available on premises or in the cloud, very easy to get to. We saw that you can authenticate. Windows authentication on the WCF service, very easy to do. We use the credential picker to pop up that UI. You can authenticate using Active Directory in Azure. Not easy to do in WCF, but doable. Very easy to do with an Azure Mobile Service. And we took a look quickly at things like security and testing and reviewed deployment. So Windows 8, I know we spend a lot of time talking about the consumer apps. A lot of the press you read is about the consumer apps. When we introduced it, we worked very hard to go after the apps that people would want to bring them to the device. But if you think about what Windows 8 is and what Windows Store apps are and how you build them in Visual Studio, obviously, you should not just look at the consumer side. The commercial side, the line of business app side is certainly something you could and should think of, because you can build very good, very useful line of business apps. And if you combine the ease of use with the live tiles and the secondary tiles, you might even find that the Windows Store version of the line of business app is more productive and better for the users than the WPF or Silverlight or WinForms or ASP.NET version. So certainly something to look at. And again, you already know most of what you need to know to get started doing this. All right. Thank you very much.